In the fall of 1997, the University of Michigan football team was riding high. They were ranked sixth in the country, and they seemed to be on their way to returning Wolverine football to the place of preeminence it had enjoyed for decades before a recent spate of mediocre seasons. Now, all Michigan backers know not to take a conference opponent for granted, but in hosting perennial Big Ten doormat Northwestern, Michigan would be forgiven if they assumed victory. Only by halftime, they were struggling. It seemed Northwestern had crawled inside the heads of the Michigan coaching staff, almost anticipating plays before they were executed. Enter Jonathan Datz, a student ball boy for Michigan. From his vantage point on the Northwestern sidelines, he saw something unfolding that would change the course of the game. In fact, he couldn't believe it. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing, Mike?
So what you say?
Well, when we came out in the third quarter, as opposed to the first and second quarter, our offense was not moving, and there was a guy on the sidelines that was with another student manager, Mike Utan, and he was there. This guy had a hat backwards, pretty sure he was wearing glasses, and sure enough, as we would send our signals in, as quick as he could, he would yell in to the defensive Northwestern's defense what we were about to run, and he was good. He was on the money. So obviously, when you see that, gives you a little panic.
And that guy who you just mentioned was David Hansberg. David's with me. Hey, David.
How you doing, Mike?
So what were you actually doing there to benefit the Northwestern defense? And in what capacity were you acting?
Well, my experience as a coach and in breaking down film, you know, allowed me as director of football operations when I was on the sidelines now in 97 to watch if opponents were signaling in their offensive plays. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with my background and my experience, I was usually able, if teams did not disguise it, to decipher their hand signals.
Right.
And that's essentially what I was doing.
How complex were their signals? I mean, if they really knew someone was onto their code, would they have been that easy to crack?
It's more about how many people they use to signal and if they try and disguise who the live signal caller is. And on that day, Michigan was only using one backup quarterback. So there was only one person to watch, and there was never any question as to who was actually giving the signals because mm-hmm. it was the one guy.
Now, did you go in knowing what the Michigan code would be, or did you just figure it out as the game unfolded?
No, and I figured it out in the first quarter.
Now, we'll get to how you guys met years later, which is great, but let's go back to 97. And Jonathan, now David is essentially director of football operations. You know, that's a paid position with Northwestern. He's a little older than you. You were just a student manager, right, Jonathan?
Just a student manager. I was a senior that year. And I guess that year I had an unbelievable opportunity. I was just in the right place at the right time.
And so my question is, though, as a student manager, to get what you had learned or were suspecting, which is that Northwestern was on to Michigan signals, to get that information to someone on the Michigan sidelines who could do anything about it, it's not that easy. You couldn't just walk up to the coach and say, hey, coach, you remember me, because he probably wouldn't. So what did you do to get him that information?
We needed to run around, and I would never in a million years run up to Coach Carr and say, hey, this is what's happening over on the other side. But Coach Carr, during every game, had a manager with him, our senior manager, Eddie Magnus, and we were trying to get the information to Eddie so he could relay it on to Coach Carr.
And Eddie's job is basically he's the guy who walks around with those headphones to make sure the coach doesn't trip.
He's that guy.
And so Eddie probably doesn't, even though he's literally next to Coach Carr a lot of the time, he never talks to Coach Carr. I mean, the coach doesn't want the headphone guy to distract him, right?
We're barely supposed to be seen, less heard.
So how does Eddie actually wind up communicating what his friend, you, John, have figured out?
Well, I wasn't there for that. I'm assuming he just, eventually after we were getting certain plays blown up that should have never been blown up, in that down and situation, eventually he just couldn't keep it to himself anymore and told Coach Carr.
So, David, when did you see a shift in Michigan if they changed play calling? In other words, could you sense that they were on to you?
Oh yeah. I knew they were on to me. And, you know, the first thing I noticed was the ball boys who have every right to be on your sideline. I know the Michigan ball boys were there, and I noticed them getting close to me in the first half and trying to see what I was doing.
Yeah.
But I knew something was up. I actually thought they would go in at halftime and say something. When they came out in the third quarter and they were still signaling with one quarterback, I wondered. They were still trying to see if I was doing it. I knew that. But there was nothing I could do. I mean, there's very little subtlety to it because
yes.
once you know the play, the only way to signal it in your defense is to scream it.
Right. Once you know, it's like once you know your phone line's being tapped, you make adjustments.
Right.
Yeah.
So
what did they do? They just put a couple dummies next to the guy?
Somewhere in the fourth quarter, all of a sudden, they had three people signaling.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an immediate change, and I knew right away they were on to me.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was no reason for them to do that unless they knew. But what made it tough is they would signal three different signals in, but I just didn't know which one was the live one.
Right.
So in the fourth quarter, there was definitely a shift, and I knew they were on to me. I mean, there was no question about it.
Now, we didn't get into the score at the time, but was Michigan – I know they were ahead by halftime.
Mike, my memory was, I believe it was 13-3 at halftime, and then Northwestern got a field goal in the third quarter. It was 13-6.
Right.
But, you know, my memory of that day, and I've never seen a copy of the game tapes, but that day, the third quarter, our offense didn't score at all. I think that was the only quarter we were shut down. I don't think our offense was moving the ball at all. I'd be real curious to see how many first downs we got.
We were still in it in the third quarter because their offense really couldn't go anywhere. But I believe there was a drive in the fourth quarter, and Jonathan can confirm this, where it was a pretty sustained drive. Once I couldn't get the signals once they had the multiple signal callers, and they had a significant drive for a touchdown in the fourth quarter that pretty much sealed it.
All that said, I don't think there's any way for us to come on the air and say, but for the fact we ran around and told Coach Carr, we wouldn't have won. I guess there's no way to know that.
But that's – even so, guys in your backfield on a third and 10 when everyone expects you to pass and you call a draw and Northwestern reads draw, that's a huge advantage for Northwestern.
Well, of course. Yeah. Every yard counts.
Yeah. What you did decide to do after college is go to law school, and you wound up as a deputy district attorney in Broomfield County, Colorado. So tell me how you came across the Hansberg family.
Well, I guess by chance, Dave's wife had the bad fortune of getting her car broken into. She had a significant amount of items taken from her car, and I was assigned the case. David's wife, very fairly so, was nervous about getting up on a witness stand. So what I'd like to do in that situation, I think it's very important that I show I'm willing to go and meet people on their own turf and show them at the very least that even though they're going to be in an intimidating environment such as a courtroom, that at least they'll have a friendly face in there, me. You know, I'll be the one asking them questions at least initially. And that could take some of the stress out of being on the witness stand. So called up the Hansberg family and made plans to go over to the house that day.
And the name David Hansberg, though, didn't mean anything to you?
Absolutely meant nothing.
So, David, when this guy, you know him from the DA's office, Jonathan Datz, he comes in. How did you guys figure out the connection?
Well, I think we had an initial conversation about what I did and that I had worked at CU. And I was on the football staff. And so when Jonathan showed up at the house, and Holly, my wife, was still out running a quick errand, you know, we just started talking a little bit, and Jonathan started his line of questioning, I should say. And he started, as lawyers can do, taking me down a path, and I, of course, knew where he was going. But I just had a feeling that this was going to come up. I really did, because he just started asking specific questions about the game in 97. He told me he was a ball boy. And then when he, should I say, popped the question, and I divulged myself, I revealed myself. Just I wish we had on videotape Jonathan's face, because it was awesome. It really was awesome.
So, Jonathan, tell me the story from your side. When did it dawn on you who this guy could be?
Well, as I was asking him the questions, and I found out that as soon as he answered the question that he worked for Northwestern in 97,
yeah.
Then I'm thinking to myself, you know what? This looks like the guy.
Right.
The guy with the hat backwards with the glasses. I mean, this guy in my mind is, you know, it was kind of just a legend in my mind. You know, Dave says he wishes there was a camera there, but I'll never forget. I asked Dave the question. I say, do you remember a guy – on the sidelines that day whose job it was to steal our signals. And I wish we had the camera that would show Dave's face, because Dave's face just lights up. But he got that look, and as soon as his face lit up, I knew that it was the guy.
Now, I think maybe a lot of people listening to this, they're thinking of this recent scandal with the Patriots, or maybe it was a non-scandal, but that was videotaping and cheating in the NFL. This is really a lot different. Tell me, kind of talk through the ethics of what you were doing, David. Is there really an ethical problem with what you were doing?
No, because, you know, the NFL is a little different. For one, they play most of their opponents twice in a year, and so there's benefit to you videotape an opponent's signals, and you figure you're going to play him again, and now you have him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the college game is a little more pure, and certainly we never videotaped anybody. And
in all sports, you watch for the opponent's tendencies, like in, you know, a pitcher could tip his curveball, meaning he holds
totally.
His glove a certain way, and you know what pitch is coming.
You know, when you get one of those, it's a huge advantage, but it's just part of the game. It's just part of the preparation, and if a guard is slightly back, they know maybe he's pulling. If a running back is slightly forward, it's probably a pass, and he's cheating forward to help himself pass protect. I mean, there's a myriad of things to look for that, like I said, the regular person off the street has no idea and can't really tell the difference with their eye. But ethically, this is just part of the game. And if you're going to give your opponent an opportunity to, you know, figure out your play, then, you know, shame on you. Take your chances.
And Jonathan, since this story came out, has Charles Woodson or Tom Brady or any of the other Wolverines contacted you and say, hey, thanks, we never knew that?
Absolutely not. I wouldn't expect it.
Well, anyone else? I mean, what kind of reaction have you gotten to the story? A little of the glory that bypassed you back in 1997?
I'd say the extent of it is some old friends who I've been long out of contact with, which I regret. I've gotten back into contact. I think that's by far the best part of the story.
Well, Jonathan Datz, former Michigan ball boy and now a deputy district attorney in Broomfield County, Colorado, and David Hansberg, who used to be the director of football operations now at Northwestern. He now manages and directs the Rocky Mountain Day Camp in Superior, Colorado. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome, Mike.
So one motif of this hour is good stories well told. I thought the guys did a good job with theirs. And before we were talking to the booklamp.org guy, his whole idea is, let's say you like one story, how to find others that will also be of your liking. And I was thinking, well, what about the opposite? You read a book and you're like, oh man, I'm really going to get into this genre, or I'm really going to get into this author. And like everything else leaves you cold. So I was asking my fellow BPPers and Trish McKinney's here. You ever have an experience like that?
Yeah, it was. I'm a big fan of Willa Cather, so I read pretty much everything she wrote. And then I was running out of Willa Cather, and I'd heard a lot of people say that she was very influenced by Sarah Orne Jewett. And if I liked Willa Cather, I would like Sarah Orne Jewett. And I have to say, I could not get into Sarah Orne Jewett.
She's kind of forgotten Sarah Orne Jewett. I think she died by getting hit by a wagon. Quite young.
I don't know. And I feel bad. If that's the case, I feel even worse. But yeah. I just couldn't get into her.
She didn't get hit by a wagon run by Willa Cather, though. Mark Garrison, you have any experience with this? A book or a series that left you cold, even a whole genre?
It's Proust, basically. And I had a friend who, we were both reading books about the life of the mind. And he had a couple books that he liked. And I was like, oh, I'm reading the seven volumes of Proust. I'm like, which one are you on? He's like, I'm on four. They're great. I'm like, well, I'm going to go get Swan's Way. I'm going to start. And it's the only book I remember that I couldn't finish. It's not even close to the seven volumes, but not even that one book. I was like, I'm going to read this far enough to get to the cultural reference point about Madeline's, and then I'm done.
You know what's hard? That's the first page. But what's hard is the first 100 pages is all about him trying to sleep, and I just kept falling asleep.
Yeah.
So he did his job. For me, it's Metallica. After Master of Puppets, the rest of it just left me cold. Anyway. That is it for the Bryant Park Project today. All of our... they didn't write a book? I mean the lyrics. That's it for the Bryant Park Project. We're online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Mike Pesca. I say it because I mean it. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.